The Lima Coast to Coast, Show 36, November 14th, 2006. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. Before getting into the podcast, I'd like to remind listeners that there are four ways to contact the show. The first is via email, podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com. The second is via the website, www.thelemacoasttocoast.com. Third is via our voicemail, 206-600-5782. And the voicemail is the encouraged format. And, of course, via mail at Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, 30065. And that's in the United States. Also, in addition to those ways to contact the podcast, I also have a MySpace page, www.myspace.com/Thelema Coast to Coast. And there's right now a little over 1,100 people subscribe to that, and there's also a Frapper map that has over 400 people, so I encourage you to go check those out. You can get to the Frapper map by going to the Thelema Coast to Coast website and clicking on the link there, the same for the MySpace. All right. Since I started the podcast, I've been having a bit of a promotion. If you send a postcard to the podcast, then in return, I will send you one of the limited edition podcast stickers to put on your car. It's a pretty large sticker, bumper sticker size. And the postcards have slowed down. I haven't gotten any recently. So encouraging all the listeners out there, especially new listeners, here's your chance to get a free sticker for the podcast. It says Thelema Coast to Coast on it, Occultism Without Apologies. All you have to do is send a postcard to Thelema Coast to Coast, P.O. Box 7045. Marietta, Georgia, 30065. And please choose a creative postcard. Make one for yourself or buy one, because all the postcards that get sent in get scanned in and put on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. Send those postcards in. All right. In the last podcast, I asked for some feedback, and I got some. So thank you very much, everybody, and keep it coming. Also said, instead of just saying, hey, John, I like the podcast, blah, 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 I'm actually interested in some kind of questions or some to get my thoughts on things. And so here are a few of the people that replied. This one is from Ryan. He says, 93, John, it's great to see the podcast keeps improving. The Stephen Skinner interview was really amazing. By the way, is he a Thelemite? No, he's not a Thelemite. The mixture of magic history with occult philosophy covers a lot of important ground, and the show seems to have struck a great balance between those two things after the excellent pieces on Russell and the influence of Tantra. One place where those two topics seem to intersect is in the work of Austin Spare. He came up in your last conversation with Keith 418 as someone who, when his work is seriously engaged in, forced people to figure out their own desires. This seems to be a theme in your discussions about the Goetia as well. I would love to hear the theme expanded on. Are there any obstacles to knowing our desires that are not self-imposed? Are there other magicians who did this kind of work, or other practices which are particularly useful when we take this line of inquiry? Thanks for the great work and all your time and energy. 93, Ryan. Ryan, that's a very important question, desires, and there's no way that I can touch on the magnitude of it in this brief response. However, the one thing that I frequently tell people when I talk to them about things is to ask yourself why. Why do you want this, or why do you care about this, or why is this important, or why are you interested in things? The why question is actually something that little two-year-olds do. You know, they go to their parents and say, you know, why are we doing this? And eventually it gets down to the point where the parent is frustrated and they say, because I'm the parent and I say so. Well, you can't do that with yourself. You really need to start getting down into your own motivations and start seeing where they're coming from. And what you're going to find out is most of the time, if you really get into it and start looking at where your desires are coming from, they have been programmed into you from various aspects of society, things that you've been told that you want, or things that your parents or family members or friends or organizations or the media, all of those influences that are around us totally infiltrate our minds, and they condition us to wanting certain things. A new pair of shoes comes out and somebody wants it. Or children, there you can totally see how this happens with children on Saturday morning cartoons, where they see action figures or dolls or toys or whatever. Cartoons are no longer entertainment now. They're 30-minute commercials for toys of some kind. And so what you could see is how all these external things are manipulating your desires. And so what you have to do is you start have to ask yourself, why do I want this? Why is this important? What is meaningful about this? And you really have to start looking inwardly and start looking at these desires, because that's ultimately where you're going to find your power and your ability to command goetic spirits, or your ability to make talismans and things like that. If the power of your desires is coming from some kind of external manufacturer, then it's not really you. It's not really willful. You're just being manipulated. But if you can really start digging in and figure out the things that are really important to you, really meaningful in your desires, your will, and things of that nature, and I'm not conflating the two, but I'm saying that there is a connection between the two. But all of those things really are what can be your internal power center to manifest, and that's ultimately what magic is, isn't it? Causing some kind of manifestation in your life. So that's where we're kind of getting into the desires. What do you really desire, and why do you really desire it? You will be surprised if you do this why exercise to yourself and you get really, really honest. When you first start it, you're going to start hitting impasses. You're going to ask yourself why, and you're going to get to a point where you don't know. You just do. And that's the time to get really introspective and really start getting honest. And this is what's really difficult when you get honest, because you're going to have to start looking at your fears, your deep wants, places where you've been hurt, people that have let you down, things that you're building these defenses. Why are you projecting these images? Why are you going through all of this representation? Why are you going through all of these motions? And these are very difficult things to look at, but they're vitally important to do to move forward on the magical path. So that's a little bit of why desires are important, Ryan. And again, always ask yourself the question why, and don't let up even if you get to an impasse. Keep asking yourself. So thanks for the question. The next one is from a listener named Michael. It's less of a question. He just wanted to comment about my mention of Lonely Girl 15 in the last podcast. He writes, I listened to your last episode with interest. I, along with some other Thelemites, have been using the Lonely Girl 15 series to our advantage. Several Thelemites post on forums from time to time, but there is a tendency for religious discrimination there. People can attack Thelemites' religions and them personally, but the mods will look the other way. They will, in a sense, encourage it while claiming that personal attacks are not allowed. So I decided to start doing videos and making video replies to the Lonely Girl 15 videos. I've received many emails from the people who have never heard of Thelema before Lonely Girl 15. They are very interested in the subject matter. I usually refer them to hermetic.com so they can read Crowley's writings themselves, with my primary direction being towards the commentary of the Book of the Law. In it, I discuss several aspects of Thelema in a way that non-Thelemites will identify with and understand. A Thelemite may laugh at a video entitled, Am I a Satanist? But that is a very popular first question for many who are just beginning to come into contact with Thelema. Consequently, the video has been very popular. I've gotten many emails from people thanking me for doing it. It's easy for us to laugh and dismiss something out of hand, but if we take the time and look at the situations, sometimes we can use it to our advantage. If you'd like to see my first episode of A Thelemite Speaks, you can do so by visiting YouTube and searching on the username Tanhouse, T-A-N-N-H-A-U-S. In my first episode, I discuss how do it thou wilt does not equal do what you want. I also discuss how Thelema is not simply worship of the flesh repackaged for a new age. Also, in the beginning of the episode, I play your comments about Lonely Girl 15, giving you and Thelema Coast to Coast full credit, of course. 93, Michael. Well, Michael, I did take a look at that, and I think it's nice that you're out there trying to let people know about Thelema and this and that. If people are interested in checking it out, go to YouTube.com and search on Tanhouse, T-A-N-N-H-A-U-S. All right. The next email is from a listener named Steven. He says, Greetings, John 93. I just wanted to tell you how much I appreciate Thelema Coast to Coast. I've been seriously studying Thelema, Hermeticism, and other esoteric subjects for about a year now, and Thelema Coast to Coast has helped to direct me and provide depth to my studies. Nevertheless, I still find that I am perplexed by a seemingly simple question. Is Thelema a religion? If Thelema is a religion, what are the characteristics that make it a religion in the traditional sense of the word? Or is religion a misnomer for Thelema since the word religion carries connotations of the old eon? From my readings of Crowley thus far, I'm under the impression that one isn't to attach a paradigm to their magical experience because it affects the experience. Would Thelema be similar to how Masons refer to Masonry as their craft? Thanks again for all your time and hard work in creating an interesting program. 93, Steven. Well, this is not a new question. First, recommend that you go read Crowley's answer to this question. He specifically has a chapter in Magic Without Tears, Is Thelema a New Religion? So that's the first place you'll go there, and you'll find out that Crowley says, yes, you could call it a religion because it meets certain criteria, but he's not entirely sure what you'll gain. The religion, not a religion debate is quite frequent within the Thelemic community, and ultimately I think it's kind of a silly debate. My experience is that Thelema can be a religion for someone, and it can be a philosophy, it can be a religious philosophy, spiritual philosophy. It can be any number of things. The problem is these definitions, these words are pretty nebulous. Just kind of what you were saying, a misnomer there. Religion, especially in Western countries, in the United States, Western Europe, and so forth, has the connotation of theism. Whether it's monotheism or even something like Hinduism, that has some kind of god associated with it. And Thelema really doesn't have any theistic aspect to it in that nature. We don't look up and see Rahu or Kui, you know, sitting in heaven and worship him or anything like that. Although I have seen some Thelemites who take Nuit Hati and Rahu or Kui to be actual living entities. For the most part, everybody that I know and interact with looks at those as more symbols or ideas than actual entities that are kind of living in some kind of celestial abode. Nevertheless, there is a religious aspect to Thelema. Now, some people will turn around and say, oh, right, that's the EGC. But no, move that on the side. The reality for me is that I think the distinction between philosophy and religion is kind of a false one. If you look at most philosophers, they end up talking about religion. And if you look at most, or anyone involved with religion, any kind of religious leader, ultimately they end up talking about philosophy. So the West has tried to bifurcate the two to say that theology is one thing and philosophy is the other. In Eastern countries, there's no separation whatsoever. Religion and philosophy go together. So I would kind of equate Thelema in its application to, like, Buddhism. Is Buddhism a religion? Well, in the most general sense, yes. But if you ask a Buddhist, is it a religion? More often they'll say, no, it's a practice or it's some kind of spirituality. But by using the word religion, you start imposing this kind of theistic idea on it, which really doesn't have a place in Thelema or in Buddhism. So is it a religion? Well, do you want it to be one? And what are the advantages of calling it a religion? What does that do for you? Is that give you something to hold on to? Does that make you feel better? What is your motivation? Going back to that previous person, ask yourself why you want to call it a religion or you don't want to call it a religion. See why that's meaningful to you. For me, I usually just call it a philosophy. Sometimes I call it a religion. Makes no difference to me. So, hope that helps, Stephen. All right, the next email is from a listener named Brian. He says, "Hello, John 93. I'm a solitary occult student, and my studies began researching Wicca, yoga, Gnosticism, and finally led to Crowley's work. I've been reading the books and am still somewhat lost in the numbers and charts. Your podcasts have helped me make sense of Crowley's work, and I greatly appreciate your time and work. I find that the podcast I enjoy the most is when you have used the time to explain the theories in practice in understandable terms that I can comprehend. Have you ever considered turning your podcast into a, quote, Crowley College, close quote, so to speak, where you could give lectures to a novice such as myself who is just beginning to learn the material? It's just a thought. I don't mean to come off as lazy when it comes to the work. I love doing research in this area. But it would be nice to be able to go to a podcast and be lectured and taught some of the material. Thanks and keep up the great work. 93 Brian." Well, Brian, in response to your Crowley College, it's a very amusing name, but no, I've never considered that, have absolutely no interest in doing that, and I would recommend someone who is a solitary occultist to stop it. Go out and join an organization that has educated, capable, engaged people that you can learn from. Occultism is a very difficult thing, and that is why there are teachers out there in various levels. Don't expect to have one teacher to teach you everything. Go around and find people who can teach you various aspects. If this person knows tarot, learn tarot from them. If this person knows Enochian, learn Enochian from them. They don't have to know everything. But you can only get so much from a book. Nevertheless, go get the books, read them, and practice them. This is a subject that keeps coming up. I'm interested in exploring Thelema as it's manifesting today. If you're a novice, if you're just beginning and a lot of these ideas don't make sense to you, go out and buy the books. Get involved with a local organization. A podcast is not a replacement from being involved in something like the OTO or the Temple of Thelema or any of the groups that are out there. Find other practitioners who have the same interest and learn from them. That's how this works. And by being a solitary occult student, you're not helping yourself. So I'm not going to be turning this into Crowley College. I will have various things at times, like the lectures on Enochian or the Goetia or various talks of how magic is implemented in different people's lives and so forth. And keep in mind, magic is about the implementation and changing of the universe in your life. So everything from getting a job to keeping your house to all the very mundane things of even paying your bills is part of magic. So you need to keep that in mind too. If you can't keep a roof over your head, how are you going to do any kind of long-term magical practice? So anyway, thanks for the email. Again, contact some kind of local group and learn from them. And the podcast is here to supplement that kind of stuff, but certainly is not a course on tape or anything like that. All right. The last feedback is kind of an expansion from what Brian was saying. So here's Nathan.
Hi, my name's Nathan. I just wanted to call and say good job on the show. It's an excellent resource, although I am not a Thelemite myself. I'm a member of the Golden Dawn community. I really enjoy and look forward to hearing your podcast. Now, having said that, I'll offer a tiny bit of constructive criticism. I would really like to hear a lot more talk about Crowley's work about perhaps works that the OTO is involved in now. Things of a scholastic nature, research into Crowley's work, ideas on uses of the calls and other facets of Thelema. And I'd love to hear more on the Kabbalistic side of it all. Of course, being a member of the Golden Dawn, I have a different viewpoint on some of the issues or some of the work, but I would still enjoy hearing it discussed, and I think many people would benefit from it. Lately, the show has tended towards interviews about the goings-on and the politics of the OTO, and I think really for the wider community of people who listen to the podcast, we'd be a lot more interested in hearing about actual occultism rather than just the politics. Anyway, thanks so much for the show, and I'll be listening. Have a great one.
93.
Nathan, I'm sure you kind of got the gist of where I'm coming from in reply to your feedback. I do appreciate you leaving voicemail. I really appreciate you leaving voicemail. But again, you know, it seems to me that a lot of the listeners are looking for some kind of magical tourism or to live vicariously from me or Keith418 or other people who come on here to talk about their magical experiences, and that's really not what it's for. I'm not going to say too much more about this because actually Keith418 and I get into this subject and respond. So thank you for sending the voicemail, and I really encourage people to send feedback. This is actually one of the most entertaining aspects of the podcast to me, and kind of is what keeps me motivated to doing the podcast. So please send the feedback. Do it through the website, via email, or especially via voicemail. All right, so now we're going to move into our interviews. We have three today. The first is with David Shoemaker. He was on the podcast before talking about the OTO's Psychology Guild. He's also a member of the Temple of Thelema and College of Thelema, and so he and I spent a few minutes talking about that organization. Afterwards, Keith and I discuss magic and its relationship to the real world and give some feedback. Lastly, I have an interview with Christopher Knowles. Christopher wrote a essay that was published this summer in the UK called Symphony of the Devil. He wrote an article where he interviewed Bobby Boussoulet, Kenneth Anger, and worked with someone else to interview Jimmy Page, and looked at the creation of the music and the video of Lucifer Rising and the whole backstory and how all that came together and all the conflict and all the crazy shenanigans that took place in the creation of the Lucifer Rising video and all of its like invocation on my demon brother and Jagger and everybody who was involved with it. It's a very fascinating article, and it was published in this summer in the UK, and it is being republished in this month of November. And so we talk about that. It's a fascinating interview that really gets into Kenneth Anger, Jimmy Page, Bobby Boussoulet. We talk about Manson, and we kind of talk about how all of this was coming together and how all of these various infamous people kind of came together for this one project and how it played out. So I'm hoping most people will find that interesting. And then after that, got the closing song and comments and so forth. So let's get into the interview with David Shoemaker.
We have on the phone with us David Shoemaker from the College of Thelema and Temple of Thelema. Are you there, David?
I am here, John.
Welcome to the podcast, 93.
Thank you for having me, 93.
The Temple of Thelema and the College of Thelema have been around for quite a while. Can you start off by giving us a little history of how they started and what the relationship of the College of Thelema and the Temple of Thelema are?
Sure. Well, probably everyone knows about Phyllis Seckler, Sora Merrill, from her involvement in Thelema in the last many decades. But in 1973 or thereabouts, she started the College of Thelema as an avenue for more structured training in the disciplines that to her mind, would lead someone toward a stronger preparation for the AA work, for magical work in general. So the college was founded as an educational institution where each student would get an individual teacher, and they would be instructed in astrology, magic, Kabbalah, tarot, in a structured curriculum, one-to-one training as well as group classes. And she taught for the college for many years out of her home in Dublin, and then later in Oroville. Then around 1989, Phyllis, as well as James Eshelman and Anna Kriya King, co-founded the Temple of Thelema, which is an initiatory outgrowth of the college, and that kind of brings us up into the modern era in terms of what the temple does. I think that basically covers the roots of the college, which was your main question there.
Right, but I'm curious, is the College of Thelema the AA lineage that through Jane Wolfe, or is it kind of a preliminary vehicle to teach certain kind of probationary information?
The college was always described by Phyllis as being in service to the AA, and meaning by that she felt the curriculum of the college was good preparation for the AA, but it's not the AA itself.
Okay, and what is the Temple of Thelema? Is that different, or is that not in service of the AA per se, or what is the relationship there?
Since the Temple of Thelema is the initiatory branch of the college, the aims are the same, but the structure and the nature of the training is expanded in a number of ways.
So the Temple of Thelema is kind of more an initiatory group environment where the college is a one-on-one kind of teacher-student, but all in preparation for doing the AA work?
Well, a student could go through the College of Thelema with the aim of affiliating with the AA, but there's
no requirement.
There's certainly no requirement, and many have done the studies for other reasons and with other aims.
So can you be a member of the college and not the temple, or vice versa? Or is it kind of one and the same in some ways?
You could certainly join the college. You definitely could join the college without being a member of the Temple of Thelema, because admission to a college doesn't confer any initiatory status. But since the Temple of Thelema is within the umbrella of the college, members are of the TOT are in the COT as well.
Okay, great. Now, there have been a long line of publications, I guess, going back, Phyllis put out In the Continuum.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still available and still being released, or since her death has that stopped?
In the Continuum began in 1973, and she published that through around 1996.
Okay.
At which point a new publication, Black Pearl, began.
Okay.
And that Black Pearl publication has ceased at this time. Black Pearl is out of print, but In the Continuum, just in the last year or so, has become available again, and ordering information is on the website for that.
Okay.
So there's about 25 years worth of In the Continuum issues there.
Wow.
Available.
Fantastic. Now, why would somebody join the college or the temple? What would be the advantage within their initiatory path?
Well, I'll describe some specifics here in a minute, but I think in general the thing that has always captivated me and impressed me about the way the way the temple structure is laid out is that it really is ground up, from the ground up, occult training. It's bread and butter. We can work with someone completely new to these studies and teach them all about tarot and astrology and Kabbalah and do that in ritual magic meditation and do that in a tightly structured way, a systematic way, and most importantly, a way that we've seen over these past years has really had powerful effects. It is replicable. It is predictable, the progress that people can make when they take these steps, and that's been extremely gratifying to see.
Approximately, what is the membership of the temple and/or college?
Well, we don't talk about numbers in that way, but we do have working groups in the San Francisco area, Sacramento, Los Angeles, forming group in New York, another group in Toronto, and other initiates scattered around the world.
So when somebody actually is doing the work of the college or temple, they actually have to be at some point physically present in one of the temples to take initiation, especially with the temple of the Lima.
Correct. We don't do so-called initiations at a distance or astral initiations, things like that. Initiation is always done in person. There are options available for people who don't live near a working group to get involved, but that still requires travel to a working group.
So there is some correspondence aspects to it, but they still have to go and physically take initiation.
It's less about correspondence and more about coming for initiation and then being able to check in person every once in a while.
Okay. The college, when a student has a superior in the College of the Lima, do they have to meet in person frequently, or is that something that is less required in person?
Different requirements at different stages of the work, but those are mostly decided on a teacher-by-teacher basis, but roughly the same. We would expect a COT student to be able to check in, just broadly speaking, at least a couple times a year.
Now, check into their local temple, like if they were in L.A., or always into kind of the headquarter area?
Speaking specifically for COT, that they would check in with their teacher.
Okay.
Wherever they were located.
Okay, great.
Okay. If I may, I'd like to describe a little bit about the specific structure of the TOT and
yes, please
what's
do.
Unique about it.
Yes.
As I said, this was founded in 1989, and there were some very specific aims in mind. First of all, it is a lineal descendant of the Golden Dawn, and so it is set up on a Tree of Life degree-based framework, and it conforms to the Cypher Manuscripts format, but with some important changes. Obviously, and most importantly, it's all in conformity with the Law of Thelema. That was a primary aim.
Right.
As may be obvious from the name. And also, you know, 100 years had gone by since the original Golden Dawn had been working, so that's a lot of available growth in understanding and in technology in terms of the mystical and magical processes that had not really, that one couldn't have incorporated if one were just going to go back and do the Golden Dawn rituals without updating them. So there's 100 years of mystery schools that have been researching. There's 100 years of modern depth psychology, Jungian work, and transpersonal psychology. All of that has been incorporated, I think, masterfully into the TOT system. And then finally, it was an important aim in the founding of the TOT to remove all the residual sexism that was inherent either overtly or more subtly in the tradition. And so I think there's been a lot of effort, successful effort at doing that as well.
Fantastic. Now, if somebody wanted to get in touch with the TOT or COT, how would they do so?
One of the easiest things to do is go to the website, which is www.thelema.org. On that website, there are contact emails and, in some cases, phone numbers for all of the College of Thelema campuses and all of the Temple of Thelema working groups. Also, as I mentioned before, that link to the ordering information for In the Continuum is on there.
All right. Well, is there anything else you want to add?
I think not. I just would reiterate that I've always felt that this system as it exists is a really solid fundamental training in a lot of the subjects that most of listeners to this program are interested in. And I was lucky to find it very early in my magical exploration and have never regretted it at all. So if anyone is interested, I certainly encourage them to give us a call and go from there.
Fantastic. I'll have a link to the Thelema.org website. Thanks for being on the show again, David. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks very much for having me.
93.
After the interview was completed, David asked me to give a few other notes. There is a Temple of Thelema forum at hururaha.net. That's HERURAHA.net. And that is the Temple of Thelema forum. So anybody can go to that, register, and communicate with the Temple of Thelema. Also, as David mentioned, there is a Temple of Thelema, College of Thelema lodge or body opening up in New York. And the one of the founders of the Temple Thelema, Jim Eshelman, will be giving a discussion in New York City on Sunday, December 3rd. And it's called the Initiation, New Awakenings in the Aeon of Horus. And that's going to be at the Open Center on 83 Spring Street in New York. Suggested donation of $13. And to get any information, you can go to www.iwas.org. That's AIWASS.org/lecture. Or you can email contact@iwas.org. So, go check that out. All right. So, as I said earlier, Keith and I talked about some of the kind of real-world aspects of what magic is all about. And this is in reply to the voicemail that we received earlier. So here is the discussion with Keith.
Keith, welcome back to the podcast, 93.
Hey, 93, John.
I sent you a voicemail from a listener who was critiquing the podcast, and in particular our conversations about being too political and not being involved in the occult, so that he was separating or making a difference between true occultism and like the politics of organizations like the Order. He also was requesting more shows about magic, and I guess the more nuts and bolts about the ceremonial magic. You said you wanted to respond to that. So what are you thinking in response to that kind of request?
Well, I think it's an interesting kind of criticism, and I think it reveals some things that we need to look at, and maybe you need to look at as you do the show. We can only really talk about the stuff that we're interested in right now and that we think is compelling and important. And I personally think that the political problems within the OTO and its structure and what it does or doesn't do is occult and is magical. So I don't really see the difference between what we discuss in terms of values and ideological migrations away from Thelema, for example, as being anything but a magical and occult discussion. What I think isn't really pertinent or magical or occult is sort of Sudoku kinds of Kabbalistic discussions divorced from practical application or what's really going on in the real world. And Crowley himself was frustrated with what he saw as the inclination of his students to escape from reality. And he said, you know, one of the biggest problems I have is that people come to me looking for insight and knowledge and experience and teaching, and what they're really looking for is an escape from reality because their lives are screwed up or for whatever reason. And I think when I hear people saying, could you guys talk more about Kabbalism or magic, often what I hear is, please stop talking about what's going on in the real world and give us a sort of magical tourism ride into Charlie and the Chocolate Factory's, you know, universe of fun and magic and Hebrew letters and flames and all that groovy stuff. And the problem with that is that to me, if it's unconnected to reality and if it's abstracted away from our experience, then it's just boring to me and I could be reading science fiction.
Well, why do you think it is that people only see kind of the as the term I've used before, the low-hanging fruit, as real occultism, and they don't look at the philosophical, metaphysical, ontological aspects of the things that underlie these techniques. They get so focused on the material and the making their altars and their swords and things like that, but then they don't actually do anything with it, nor do they think about the larger implications on why those work.
Well, again, I mean, I think that they're trying to escape from reality rather than confront it. Magic is not about an escape from reality. Magic is about reality. Crowley says this explicitly in Magic and Theory and Practice. But it's one of those things that people that get attracted to the occult tend to ignore. You know, we've seen this even with very so-called very advanced OTO leaders, where they'll sit at meetings and want to talk about, you know, the mystic number of the mass, or like the secret symbolism of where you make the crosses if you're the deacon during some part of the Gnostic mass. And this is like their big issue, in that they're all interested in various debates about this. But when it comes to things like who's actually paying the rent, and how is the organization going to buy property, and how are decisions being made to allocate resources, that's boring. That's too much like the real world. They don't want to talk about that, and they don't really want anyone else to talk about it either, or think too much about it. And to me, this is like, you know, we're trying to enjoy the Star Wars movie, and you're talking about the water bill kind of dispute. But if you're oriented towards reality and towards the real world and your real experiences, then that's what you want to look at. You want to look at these conflicting values. And part of the thing you're also asking is, you know, why they're not interested in the philosophy and the ontology. A lot of the times, they just haven't done the work yet. I mean, when you start actually doing real magical work, scrying the aethers or doing other kinds of astral work, that's the things that you go up there to look at. You go to look at organizations. You go to look at the Thelemic community. And when I and my friends were doing a lot of astral work at one time in my life, that's what we went to go look at. What are the occult forces influencing the Thelemic community? That, to me, is an interesting question. Now, it doesn't seem that interesting to other people, and a lot of times I think that they're reluctant to look at the things that actually affect their lives and instead want to look at things that they don't have any impact on at all. You know, for example, we see a lot of the time people complaining about us talking about OTO politics. But those same people talk endlessly, in many instances, about conventional politics, and no one ever tells them to shut up. I mean, how many times has someone come to you and said, I really wish you'd stop talking about OTO politics? Oh, plenty of times, I'm sure.
Yes,
but
absolutely.
No one has ever come to you and said, I wish you'd stop talking about George Bush. Why right. is it that the people in the OTO spend more time worrying about conventional politics, which they have very little chance of influencing directly, and very little time at all focusing on OTO politics, which, because it's a small organization and needs a lot of help, their individual participation could be crucial, and that they have a much better chance of making actual change. The thing that they actually have power over, they avoid looking at. The thing they have no power over whatsoever, they spend all this time talking about.
Right.
That's stupid.
There's ideas in effectiveness called spheres of influence, and they're completely inverse. They spend all of their times on the outest rings of the spheres that they have no influence and completely neglect the aspects where they do.
Right, but if you look at these people closely, you'll see that they're out of shape, they're fat, they eat badly, they don't pay attention to yoga work that's very demanding, they avoid physical challenges. They're basically, you know, creeping along trying to stay as far away from reality as they can. They're like science fiction, you know, the conventional stereotype of science fiction nerds who just, you know, want to sit around living in a dream world because their reality is so disgusting. Well, magic is about changing your reality so it's not disgusting anymore. But they think magic is about, you know, entertaining themselves with, you know, fantasies so that they don't have to focus on a disgusting reality.
Well, in a post that you made the other day, you made a really interesting observation about, or you were quoting Porphyry.
Yeah.
And his critique of equality in Christianity was that, you know, if people are equal, then they have nothing to strive for. They have nothing to cause them to grow or to be challenged to grow.
Right. And his specific criticism was the early Christian community's insistence on equality. You know, part of that insistence, you know, as a moral imperative, bleeds over, I think, into the insistence that people have on equality even in the OTO, which is supposedly based on, you know, pagan ideals of hierarchy and difference. Instead, you know, they're insisting, oh, no, everybody's the same, and we're all equal, and no one can be better than anybody else, because that sort of threatens that idea. But, yeah, if everyone's equal, if you are wonderful and equal and perfect when you're a Minerval, why would you ever want to take the ninth degree at any point?
Well, if you're already wonderful and equal, why do you even need the ninth degree?
Right.
So, and you can see, like, this ideology, you know, manifesting in a material way with things like the removal of the necessity to pass the written test between third and fourth degree, the removal of the necessity for the first person coming to Mass for the first time having to take communion. You could see it in all of these things in which any kind of barrier, any kind of hierarchy-making thing is removed.
Right.
And so, but it removes the challenge, it removes the necessity for people to grow.
Right. Well, again, and people are very resentful in the OTO if you don't accept them as being totally perfect just the way they are. If you say, you know, you have to change, you have to do different things, you have to grow and develop in certain ways, you have to learn things that you don't know now, they're very resentful about that. And their attitude is like, no, I'm fine just the way I am. That's what being a Thelemite is about. It's being a god already, and I shouldn't have to change or grow or do anything. And when you suggest that, like, no, maybe you're not fine just the way you are, maybe you need to change, they get very unhappy.
Well, but don't you see the connection between this ideology of equality and this escape from reality?
Sure. Who else would want equality but people who needed to escape from reality into some fantasy land where everybody's equal and they don't have to worry about being unequal anymore?
Right.
It's mostly, it appeals the most to people who deep down feel resentful and are fuck-ups, for lack of a better term.
Well, right, because in the real world, this hierarchy exists, and they find themselves on the bottom.
Right.
They don't want to do the work to get their way to the top. They don't want to struggle. So instead, they go to La La Land. They go to the 30th Ether, and they see all of these astral movies, and then they want to hear stories of other people's astral movies.
Right.
Instead of actually going up to, and talking with the entities to see what they could do to improve their lives.
Right. Well, one of the things you can also point out as well is that, you know, the people who demand this equality the most tend to be the ones that are, you know, obviously not only at the lower part of the hierarchy, but, you know, also the people who don't really follow the equality line when it counts. I mean, if you say, you know, the people who say, well, everyone's equal, and how dare you suggest that there's a hierarchy, you go, okay, well, you know, so somebody is a Nazi, they're an equal to you. No, not them. Yeah. Somebody who believes the exact opposite, or someone who's a racist or a sexist or homophobic. Oh, no. Those people aren't our equals. Well, if they're not, if their opinions aren't equal to yours, then obviously you don't really believe in equality. Oh, yes, we do. I mean, this sort of stupidity goes on all the time. It's unacknowledged in the occult community, and people would rather have you and I talk about what? Like, you know, how to do geomancy? Go buy a book by Israel Rigardi. Go look at the Golden Dawn stuff on geomancy. I mean, go and do the experiments. Write it down. Work on geomancy. What do they want from us in a podcast to talk about when it comes to that?
Do they want us to actually go through? Okay, first you do step one, you do this.
Right.
Step two, you do this.
You can read this out of a book. I mean,
exactly.
You make this point all the time. Why do people need us to talk about things on the podcast that they can go and get a book that we'll discuss? That doesn't make any sense.
Right. The podcast is not an efficient means to go through and give step-by-step aspects.
No.
A book can do that in greater detail and much more efficient. What the podcast can do is it can bring together ideas and allow people to express them in this immediate format.
Right.
But this is not, you know, instructions on tape.
Well, again, I'm curious though. I mean, if we were to get a whole bunch of these Golden Dawn people together from whatever Golden Dawn group they're working on and advance them up through all the Golden Dawn degrees from whatever system they're on to the point where they're adepts or, you know, exempt adepts, what are those people going to be working on? What are they going to be thinking about? What problems are they going to face? Are they going to face problems dealing with values and ontologies and how to look at how to create things and how to bring things into manifestation and what sort of values the things that they're creating should have or what they're fighting for on a certain highly developed plane? If they're, you know, what are they going to be concerned about at that level?
Everybody that I've ever seen who, you know, claims any kind of degree or grade within any kind of Golden Dawn, I honestly haven't been that impressed with.
Right. Well, what's important to them? What are their highest values? What are they trying to bring into manifestation? If you're a master of the temple, what temple are you the master of? And what goes on inside that temple? And what's the purpose of that temple? What is it supposed to do? People are involved in this minutia activity in the Golden Dawn of memorizing, you know, the tables or making their little weapons. To what end? What ultimately is all that leading towards? And I want to have that discussion. I don't want to have a discussion about how to consecrate a dagger. People can go read Israel Rigardi. They can come up with that themselves. I want to have the question, you know, I want to ask the question, I want to look at the debate of where is it all going? What's the aim? What's the essence of this activity? What's it about, and why is it meaningful, and why should I give a damn? I don't want to watch fat people parading around in robes, holding up little cardboard, you know, sticks or whatever, thinking that they're like the Grand Pazoo of the universe. That does not interest me. I want to know what the real purpose is behind it. And we've all been doing this long enough. We have our magical weapons. We've done our geomancy. You know, we know how to consult oracles. We can throw the Yi King. We can do all this stuff. So ultimately, having gone through all of that, what is it really all about? If you're not interested in that, you are either trying to distract yourself from problems that you probably need to look at in the real world, or you're an idiot.
All right. Well, in that nice ending there, I think we'll end this discussion today and encourage people to give us feedback, which we will try and reply to. So thanks again for being on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me, John.
93.
I hope everybody enjoyed that discussion. It's a very important subject that people start seeing the broader aspect of what magic is about, and not just thinking that it has to do with the elemental weapons and dressing in robes and things like that. Magic includes all kinds of things, including philosophy, including ontology, including politics, and so much more. And people will be better served if they start seeing the wider aspects of magic. Now, moving forward, as I said earlier, Christopher Knowles wrote the essay Symphony for the Devil, interviewed Jimmy Page, Kenneth Anger, and Bobby Boussoulet all about the creation of the movie Lucifer Rising. So here's the interview with Christopher Knowles.
We have on the phone with us Christopher Knowles. Welcome to the podcast, Christopher 93.
Thanks, John.
Now, you have an essay coming out in the November edition of Guitar World. I guess it's on the stands right now.
That's true.
It's called Symphony for the Devil, and it's a interview of Jimmy Page, Kenneth Anger, Bobby Boussoulet, all talking about the creation of the movie Lucifer Rising and the soundtrack. First, how
soundtracks.
Did... Oh, I'm sorry, soundtracks, right.
Yeah,
both Pages and Boussoulet soundtracks, right.
Mm-hmm. And Mick Jagger's as well.
Okay, right. To start off, what prompted you to create this essay or to research into this?
Well, I had been doing some work for Classic Rock, writing some feature articles, and I basically needed a new story because I didn't have anything to do for them, and had sort of run across this story over the years in various personal researches, and had read a really good book by a guy named Gary Lachman called Turn Off Your Mind that went pretty deeply into the story. And I thought there was a lot more there that people hadn't really gotten into because nobody had really spoken to the principles involved. Everybody had sort of talked to or actually gone from the public record, and nobody had really asked the actual creators of the work what they were doing and why they were doing it. So I pitched it to my editor, and it took a while for it to get off the ground, and it took a while to get in touch with everybody. Took a year from the time I had first come up with the story to the first publication of it in the summer of 2006 in Classic Rock magazine, which is out of the UK.
Right, and so the edition that's coming out now in Guitar World is a reprint
that's correct.
The one. Okay.
That's correct.
Okay, and so it took a year.
Yeah, it took a year because we were waiting for Jimmy Page to talk. I mean, he's been working on a new solo album, and he would only speak to people in the UK that he had known personally. So I was waiting for an interview to incorporate into my piece. I had already spoken to Kenneth. I spoke to Kenneth Anger last June, and I'd spoken to Bobby Boussoulet several times over the past 6 or 7 months. He's in prison in Oregon, so my contacts with him were pretty sporadic, but definitely worthwhile. There was a point when the piece was really sort of running aground, and Bobby's influence really, or his impetus, his input, really revived the piece for me personally, because I was getting pretty close to just dropping it. It's like trying to get in touch with royalty, getting in touch with Page, and even Anger, took a lot of doing. He's had some personal issues that,
right,
made it impossible for a while to get in touch with him. And, first of all, I had to find out where he was and who was dealing with him and, who was his representation and everything like that. So it was a bit of an investigational work on my part as well.
So when you contacted Kenneth Anger and asked him, you know, to give his side of the story, was he enthusiastic about it, or was he...
No, he really didn't want to talk about it at all. It took a long time. He really didn't, you know, want to go over it. He didn't want to talk about, you know, because he and Jimmy had a pretty nasty falling out over the film and over the soundtrack, and he didn't want to, you know, go over that material again. He didn't want to relive that. So it was difficult. It was difficult, and, you know, it was very difficult to get him to open up about it. I mean, he was very gracious and he was very polite, but he obviously didn't want to go over it again. I think it was a painful and, you know, episode in his life.
How did you get in touch with Bobby? Did you have phone calls with him or write him via mail or a variety of ways?
Bobby has a website online, and I had contacted him by writing through the email link on his website. And I believe I heard back from his wife first and then heard back from him. And it was actually a few months in between our email contact and our actual first phone conversation. We actually talked for the first time on December 21st of last year. And after that, he was on hold because I didn't know whether Jimmy Page was actually going to be able to contribute to the piece. He was very busy with his new solo record and didn't really have the time to talk. So Bobby and I actually spoke in April, I believe, and we had a marathon phone session, which was really great. I mean, he had incredible things to say, and he had, you know, very deep insight on the whole history of the film and the history of the 60s in general. And, you know, he's pretty knowledgeable about, you know, things like Crowley and Horace and the themes in the film as well.
Mm-hmm. Who actually did the interview with Jimmy Page, since he wouldn't let you do it?
Yeah, a journalist in England who works with classic rock named Peter Makowski. And I was sent the raw transcript that he did with Jimmy that I, you know, basically went in and, you know, cut all the juicy parts out and then put the rest into a sidebar.
Did you give Peter the questions to ask, or did Peter kind of run with it on his side and then you just kind of take what you could?
I believe Peter had seen my first draft of the article. I had written just a basic historical overview of the article without any of the interview material. And I believe that Peter had seen that and, you know, based his questions accordingly. And in addition, I mean, this story came out in the mid-70s, and there was actually a big piece in Sounds magazine, which was one of the big newspapers in England at the time, you know, concerning this whole back and forth between Jimmy and Kenneth. Kenneth had held a press conference after Jimmy had kicked him out of his house, I believe his house in Bollaskin. Jimmy, retorted, you know, he responded to the accusations that Kenneth made, and, you know, Kenneth had said that, you know, Jimmy had lost his magical powers and that he was, you know, way too hopped up on heroin to, you know, be effective anymore, and that his music was no longer, you know, truly Luciferian, in his words.
Jagger ended up doing this soundtrack. Was there any attempt to contact Mick Jagger about this?
Well, the Stones were on tour. The Stones had been on tour for their latest album, and we were unable to get a hold of them. The soundtrack that that Mick Jagger did was for an earlier version of the film that was released as Invocation of My Demon Brother. And that footage was the original footage for Kenneth Anger's original incarnation of the film, which took place in, he had a house. It was the old Russian embassy in San Francisco. They called it the Russia House. It was just off of Haight-Ashbury. And they did a, you know, number of magical rituals. And they also filmed the Rolling Stones concert in Hyde Park on July 3rd of 1969. I'm sorry, July 5th of 1969, which took place just 2 days after Brian Jones drowned in his swimming pool. So Jagger had given Anger the soundtrack based on an early cut of the film, and Jagger was actually working with a Moog synthesizer. It's a very avant-garde soundtrack. I mean, it sounds like something that, you know, somebody like Front 242 or, you know, some industrial band would do. It's really an amazing piece. The sounds nothing like the Rolling Stones at all. There's no blues influence in it at all.
But I have a copy of the Page version.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear a lot of similarities between the Page version and the soundtrack that Jagger did for that eventually was used for the 11-minute Invocation of My Demon Brother. Do you hear any similarities? I assume you've heard copy of...
Yeah, I've heard all three soundtracks. Actually, there is that first few minutes of the Jagger soundtrack. It's very dissonant and almost kind of ambient. The three soundtracks, to me, the Mick Jagger soundtrack is very dissonant, it's very driving, it's very abrasive. Jimmy's soundtrack is very meditative. He has some Buddhist chanting in there, and he has, you know, a number of different instruments. He has the tabla drums, he has 12-string guitar, and he's working with an ARP synthesizer, which is an early guitar synthesizer. And that's more almost like a Brian Eno or Terry Riley kind of piece. It's based on one chord. It's G-sharp, actually. And, it continues in that very solemn vein. You know, there's sort of peaks and valleys with it, but, you know, it's much more of an ambient piece. Bobby's soundtrack is very much along the lines of things like old Pink Floyd, especially Adam Hart Mother and, you know, those pre-Dark Side of the Moon Pink Floyd albums. I don't know if you're familiar with that music at all. But it's much more psychedelic. It's got a lot of sort of jazz and symphonic influences in it. And it's more almost of like a processional piece. You know, it's very formal and magisterial and a lot of, you know, almost like a classical feeling to it. So it's, I think all three soundtracks are, you know, really remarkable pieces of music. And they're all completely different. And consequently, Kenneth Anger's cut of each film, of each version of the film, which all began as Lucifer Rising, they correspond. You know, Kenneth Anger shot an enormous amount of footage and picked and chose the footage according to each soundtrack. So, they're three entirely separate feelings.
Okay. What kind of revelation did you get from talking, or I guess talking to Bobby and Kenneth, and then getting the interview from Jimmy? What kind of insight did you get that kind of people were not aware of before?
I think that the interesting thing about this film is that it ties in this sort of 6 degrees of separation aspect with a lot of bad news. There's a, you know, the Stones, when they played Altamont, were very much in Kenneth Anger's orbit. You had Brian Jones' death, you had the Manson story, you had John Bonham's death later on. There's a connection with the death of John Lennon. There's a lot of darkness in this film. I mean, I'm not sure why, and maybe, you know, somebody who's more familiar with, you know, Crowleyan magic than I am, you know, might be able to speak to that. But there's this incredible history of, you know, the dark side, the dark underbelly of the 1960s and the whole hippie thing that ties into this film very directly in some remarkable ways, and, you know, very strong synchronicities. But the mandate behind the film was very devotional. It was basically built, you know, around the idea of the Aeon of Horus, the emergence of this new Aeon. And the film itself, I mean, there's nothing, you know, objectionable or violent or sexual in the film itself. It's very quiet, it's very meditational, it's very symbolic. You have Isis and Horus, and then, you know, the figure of Lucifer, you have Lilith. And he filmed in Giza and in Echtenstein in Germany and in Stonehenge and, as you know, as well as London. So what is actually going on screen compared to what the history that it's snaked through, you know, the contrast there is really remarkable. And all three principals, Jimmy, Bobby Beausoleil, and Kenneth Anger, all sort of spoke, you know, that this film to them represented the emergence of the Aeon of Horus, the Aeon of the Child, you know, which I guess Crowley spoke to in the Book of the Law and maybe some other writings. You guys will be a lot more expert in that kind of stuff than I am, but you know, people who listen to your show will be, you know, very familiar with the kind of ideas and you know, impulses behind.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely correct about that. That's the it kind of runs through all of Crowley's writings about Thelema, the Aeon of Horus, and everything. Did you get any indication about, you know, how Paige feels about the fact that the soundtrack was released, and, you know, and what his thoughts were about that?
Well, the soundtrack was never officially released. It's pretty widely circulated on bootleg.
Mm-hmm.
You can get it in a lot of different, you know, maybe something like BitTorrent or something like that. I got it off an old website that had you know, bootleg MP3s and stuff. It was never actually officially released. He was very proud of the soundtrack. I mean, he was very proud of his work. It's only 22 minutes. Kenneth Anger claimed that he needed, you know, 40 or 90 or something like that. You know, the story changed a lot. But I think he really wanted that to come out. And, you know, it may yet, you know, have an official release. You know, I wouldn't close the door on that. You know, he feels very strongly about the work. He really felt, you know, very, very positively about the original incarnation of the film, which you can also get, you know, floating around. Somebody had gotten one on eBay that has Jimmy's soundtrack with Kenneth's cut that corresponds to that soundtrack, which Jimmy says, you know, the correspondents, you know, they were working separately. They were working apart from one another, and they got together, and they were just amazed that the music fit perfectly with the cut of the film and vice versa, you know, on a synchronistic level, I would suppose.
Did Anger say, you know, that there are any plans for his films to be coming out on DVD anytime soon?
Yes, there is a company, I think it's Fantomas in San Francisco or in Los Angeles, I'm not sure. There is a company that wants to release his library on DVD, but the problem is that Kenneth Anger used a lot of music, most particularly for the film Scorpio Rising, which came out in 1964. He used the music for that. It was a bunch of old doo-wop and rock and roll songs. He used them without permission, and the problem with that is they're trying to get the permission for the music, and that hasn't gone through yet. You know, the copyright holders on a lot of these old rock and roll songs, you know, are very strict about, you know, the usage of their copyrights.
So they won't release the other music without having been able to do Scorpio Rising?
Well, the plan is to release all the, you know, what Kenneth Anger called the magic lantern cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Those films, and starting with Inauguration of the Pleasure Dome, or actually maybe starting with Fireworks in 1947, but they want to release all of Kenneth Anger's films that use, you know, copyrighted music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the snag, is getting permission from the music. You know, in addition to the fact, you know, that you're dealing with, you know, independent companies who don't have a great budget. But Kenneth Anger's films, there, you know, there are a number of museums and libraries across the country that the films are in their collection. You can look that up online. I don't have the information handy right now, but there is, I believe the Whitney of the Guggenheim in New York has his films in their collection, and they show them from time to time.
Well, they also were released on VHS by Mystic Fire.
Right. Mystic Fire went out of business several years ago. They did not have the permission for the music for Scorpio Rising. They just released it and figured that nobody would really notice. But like I said, I mean, they've been out of business for several years now, and any DVD copies you get now are...
Just transfers?
Yeah, they're just transfers. They're just DVR transfers, yeah.
Okay. You know, without going too much into, you know, and repeating what's in the article itself, what was kind of Bobby's thoughts about the whole interaction with Anger in on the film and Paige and everything? You know, since you had the opportunity to speak with him, and a lot of people don't, you know, can you give a little detail on his take on the situation in the movie and so forth?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the film started with Kenneth and Bobby in San Francisco. Kenneth had met Bobby at a sort of a love-in And it was actually in a Methodist church that there was an interesting controversy there. But Bobby and Kenneth both lived in separate floors of the Russia house. And if you see Invocation of My Demon Brother, there's a lot of footage of Bobby. Bobby and Kenneth had sort of a blowout. They did an Equinox festival at the Straight Theater in San Francisco. And there was sort of a technical malfunction that Kenneth ended up blaming on Bobby. And there's actually footage from that in Invocation of My Demon Brother as well. But after that, Bobby went down to L.A. and eventually sort of fell in with the Manson bunch and ended up going to prison for killing a drug dealer named Gary Hinman. They sort of lost contact. Kenneth, after that happened, Kenneth said that, you know, he put a curse on Bobby, and that was, you know, the result of it. Then, of course, Kenneth hooked up with Jimmy Page, but after Jimmy Page and Kenneth had sort of had their falling out, Bobby had heard through the grapevine about that and contacted Kenneth, and Kenneth made arrangements with a woman named Minerva Bertholdt, who was in charge of an arts program in the prison system in California at the time, to get equipment to Bobby in prison, a film projector so he could, you know, see the film, and then recording equipment and, you know, guitars, synthesizer parts. But Bobby had constructed the synthesizers himself that he used in the film, as well as some of the other instruments. And it took a few years for that soundtrack to be made because, you know, you're obviously in prison. You don't have access, you know, full-time to a recording studio and things like that. But after the film was completed, after the soundtrack was completed, they had fallen out again and hadn't been in contact until I, you know, did the article. And the interesting thing is that their mutual friend in Los Angeles, you know, had told Kenneth and you know, that Bobby was also going to be working on this piece, and they sort of got together after that and, or reestablished contact.
So they're actually talking to each other now, as far
as
you know.
Yeah, that's one of the happy endings of this story, I guess. Bobby's a very charismatic guy. He's a great storyteller. He's got a lot of interesting stories, you know, about the 60s, about, you know, Manson, about the whole biker scene that he got mixed up in L.A., as, you know, as well as San Francisco. He was in San Francisco in 66. You know, both Kenneth and Bobby Beausoleil moved to San Francisco in 66. And, you know, it was at that point in time that Kenneth felt that, you know, the aeon of Horus was beginning. And there's a Crowley poem, I'm sure you know it, called Hymn to Lucifer.
Mm-hmm.
That was the original inspiration for the film.
Okay. Has Bobby and or Kenneth seen your article?
Bobby did, yeah. I don't know if Kenneth has seen it. I haven't been in contact with him since last year.
Any feedback from Bobby about it?
Oh, he was very happy with it. He was happy with it. Yeah.
Okay.
It really, you know, it told his story in a, in a major venue.
Right, and the article is also very sympathetic towards Bobby too. It doesn't demonize him like many other things written about him.
I think you know, my take on Bobby, I could be totally wrong, but my take on Bobby is that he's basically a guy who got mixed up with the wrong crowd. You know, he's been a model prisoner. He hasn't had any problems in prison. He's done a lot of educational work and things like that in prison. I mean, he's definitely kept his nose clean there. So, the story is that there's a lot of bad stuff going on in L.A. in the 60s. There was a lot of drugs, you know, the bikers, and it was very easy to just, you know, and plus, I mean, Charlie Manson's very charismatic guy, and brought a lot of people into his orbit. A lot of, you know, middle class kids sort of got drawn into his orbit, and I mean, that's just my take. I could be totally wrong.
Well,
but I don't, you know, I don't think Bobby's a bad guy. And he was very gracious with me and very helpful as well.
Well, you bring up Manson. You know, what did Bobby, other than, you know, the charismatic aspects of Manson, what else did Bobby say about Charlie Manson and what happened and everything?
Well, the one thing he really did talk about was, you know, Manson and his music. You know, he said that Manson was a musical genius, and that this is something I've read elsewhere, that Charlie had fallen in with Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys. Wilson would invite sort of rock royalty over to his house to jam with Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that Neil Young was definitely there, and Neil Young spoke highly of him, and I believe Jimi Hendrix was there, and, you know, maybe people like Stephen Stills and people like that, that L.A. scene. You know, I mean, Charlie, Dennis called him the wizard.
Hmm.
You know, he had this sort of rap. You know, he's one of these sort of gurus. I'm not a big expert, you know, on the whole Manson story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because when I told people that I was working on this, I mean, it seems like everybody in the world is an expert on Charlie. Everybody's telling me about, you know,
right,
this story and that story, everything like that. So, no, but Bobby's, you know, take on Charlie was that, you know, he was, you know, a brilliant guy, but very hard to manage.
To kind of change subjects here, you're also working on another book that's due to come out next year through Red Wheel Weiser called Our Gods Wear Spandex.
That's correct.
Can you just give a quick summary about what that's going to be about?
Well, basically, I'm looking at the history of comic book superheroes and tracing them back to, ultimately, to the occult explosion in Victorian England and in America as well, and how all these movements and groups basically influenced the development of these ideas of these supermen, you know, and things like, you know, the Golem, ideas from the Kabbalah, that there was this sort of convergence of ideas, you know, taken from, you know, groups like the Golden Dawn and the Theosophists that sort of wound their way into pop culture, you know, and trash culture and the pulps, and eventually into comic books. And what I'm tracing is just, you know, the exact influence and where it came from and who were the individuals involved and how this all developed. I mean, it's really an amazing story. And plus, I mean, some of your listeners might be aware that there are people, you know, one of the most prominent comic book creators now is a guy named Alan Moore.
Right.
Who is, you know, a practicing magician, has, you know, included occult works very, very specifically and very extensively in his work. Also a guy named Grant Morrison, another guy out of the UK.
Yeah, he actually kind of sees his graphic novels as talismans themselves.
I think that's sort of the way most artists will, you know, if they're honest and if they're aware, will come to see their work, you know. Yeah, I mean, Grant Morrison has sort of done experiments with rituals within the comics themselves, incorporate a lot of themes into, you know, superheroes, which to me, and, you know, my research has basically taken things back to, you know, their roots.
Right.
But, you know, my interest, you know, I've got another book that, you know, I've written that I've also been talking to Red Wheel about, that will do the same thing in film, in science fiction film. So, you know, I'm very interested, you know, in this sort of, you know, this is how the Lucifer Rising article arose, you know, in its genesis, is that I'm very interested in the collision of, you know, esotericism and the occult and alternative religion and mysticism in popular culture, the way it finds itself in a popular culture and the way it really sort of has redirected itself. You know, it sort of took a detour from groups like the Golden Dawn and the OTO, took the sideways door into the mass media. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. I mean, people don't understand how much occult symbolism and occult ideas are manifesting in our media today. It's really amazing.
It's the more aware you become of it, the more surprising it is. And my work, what I'm trying to determine is, I'm trying to determine how much of it is intentional and how much of it is unconscious. Sometimes it's very hard to tell the difference, how this material is reaching, the mass media and the mass audience, because I think people, for instance, some people will grow up listening to Jimmy Page and listen to Led Zeppelin and sort of be aware of Aleister Crowley and ideas like that, and will sort of, it's an unconscious thing that they will sort of gravitate to symbols and ideas that will...
You're speaking to one of them.
Okay. That will, that they'll manifest in their art. And, it's very interesting to me because I see these ideas as having their own reality, as having their own power. And I think a lot of people tend to, take sort of a conspiratorial outlook on it. And I don't, I think there's an element of that in some cases, but I think in other cases, ideas have their own power.
Mm-hmm.
And if an idea is valid, it's going to have a power that's going to transcend itself.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the show. And
okay.
When your book comes out next year, let me know. I would love to kind of extend the conversation about this. I've actually talked to a friend of mine who gave a paper recently about this, and it really is kind of fascinating to see how the occult symbolism is manifesting in our current culture. But going back again, this is out in the your article, Symphony for the Devil, is actually out on the newsstands right now in the United States.
Mm-hmm. So in Guitar World, that's
in
right.
Guitar World. So we're encouraging everybody to go out and check it out. It's a really fascinating article. It's actually well over, what is this now? It's like 13 pages or so. So
yeah, it was actually the longest article that Classic Rock has ever printed, and maybe the longest article that Guitar World has printed now. So.
And it also has some really fantastic artwork in it. Who is the one who did these collages?
I think his name is Stephen Williams. I'll have to check that. It's a guy out of the UK. 57 Design, it's called.
Right. Okay. Fantastic. Well, again, thanks for being on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time. 93.
I hope everybody enjoyed today's podcast. Again, I want to thank all the listeners who sent feedback. I did receive some other feedback that I didn't read, and I do appreciate people sending that too. Please keep the feedback coming. On my MySpace page for the podcast, I frequently get friended by various bands or artists who are looking to promote their music through MySpace to really kind of get their music out and get people to listen to it. And literally every day I get people friending me, and sometimes I wonder, are they even paying attention to what kind of podcast I'm putting out? I've gotten gospel singers and Christian music artists asking to friend and promote their music, so it's kind of odd. But one of the more recent artists that asked me or friended me and was looking to promote the music was a band that I really liked, actually, and they're called Trolle, and that's T-R-O-L-E, and they're at the website trole.org, and they're kind of a rock, punk, rockabilly, or kind of like wrap it all together and call it punkabilly, and I really like their music. It's not necessarily directly applicable to Thelema or magic, but it certainly has some kind of resonance with that. It's called Drug Money. So that's going to be the closing song. And again, that's Trolle at trole.org. So thanks again for listening to Podcast 36. And Podcast 37 should be coming out in probably 2 to 3 weeks. So I hope you stick around for that. And until then, thanks for listening. Love is the law. Love under will. We'll be right back.
yourself come walking in. And don't you tell my mother no, she might disown my soul. Think I never learned at all. Drug money, drug money gonna stain my soul. Drug money, drug money, drug money gonna stain my soul. Drug money gonna save my soul. Drug money, drug money, drug money gonna.